Pack your bags, start the car, and get on the road. It's time to go across the country, 2 minutes at a time, for the biggest stories of the day, where they're happening.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Boston, Mass.
Miami, Florida.
It's the 2 minute drill on the program.
That's right. You're tuned back into the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, filling in for Seren Petro alongside Curtis Seabolt. Well, it is time for the 2 minute drill. And to kick off things, we're going to head to Charlotte as we talk with Travis Hancock of 92.7 WFNZ. Travis, thanks for coming on the show today.
Hey man, thanks for having me. Hope you guys are doing well, and always appreciate it. Thank you.
We're doing fantastic here, and we're going to start it off with the Hornets hiring Charles Lee on a four-year deal to be the next Hornets coach. How are fans feeling about that right now?
It's very split for a lot of ways when you look at who it came down to. It came down to Charles Lee, who they hired from Boston with all the Mike Budenholzer Milwaukee ties. So certainly he's got a lot of. He's got a lot of guys to lean on within the league that will help him out and where he's come from. But, you know, obviously, as you can imagine in Charlotte and in sports radio, when the name J.J. Redick gets involved, that became a very, very highly contested, heated discussion because he doesn't have experience. But, you know, there's half the people here were kind of like, you know what? What do the Hornets have to lose? Like, what could it do? Set the Hornets back any further than they've been the last 20 years? And some people thought, you know, he's a smart guy. Let's see what he's got. Other people said, no way, no experience. So I was pro J.J. Redick, and I understand the pitfalls and the history of the guys that go in there without a lot of experience, without being the assistant coach. But there's as you guys know, there's a fan part of what we do. It's also a media part. And I thought, man, oh, man, this is like a walk a golden ticket for every presser. There'll be national attention because, you know, the shows will focus on him. I thought, man, fail or not, like, we got something going on here, J.J. Redick. And then the Hornets did what they did, and they went the safe route. And now we don't have that walk a golden ticket anymore.
Now, we also got to talk about the Hurricanes down 3-0 to the Rangers. Give us the pulse on how the feel is right now.
I think we're highly frustrated and about to throw in the towel. You know, as a Yankee fan, we know that we've seen before a team blow a 3-0 lead. So it's not impossible in sports. It's happened four times in hockey, but 0-for-15 on the power play. The goaltending advantage, especially the first two games, massively in favor of the Rangers. And the Rangers' star players in the big moments, the clutch moments, they perform time and time again. And the Canes are a great regular season team that their flaws get more exposed in the postseason. It's happened a couple years ago to the Rangers, last year to the Panthers, and they got dominated. And right now they're getting dominated by the Rangers. So until they fix their goalie situation to get someone in there that they can really, truly count on as a star or make some adjustments, no, the windows don't last forever. And this Canes run has been very, very good, but they're not even to the finals with this group yet. Fans are thinking, what do we have to do to get the next level? Is it coaching change, GM change? Something's got to give for the Canes to at least get to that next level, and it's not happening right now.
We'll see if they can keep things alive in that series. On to some college news. What are Duke and Carolina fans thinking about the ongoing ACC lawsuit with Florida State? And are the Carolina schools eyeing any other conferences?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you never know. We could look up in 10 minutes and the ACC could be blown up like the old stadiums do, like that we see on social media, like the Superdome. Something could explode here. But, you know, right now, Carolina is tied in to, we think, I mean, who's that? Carolina's tied into the SEC one day, the Big Ten the next day. It feels like once Florida State and Clemson kick the door open, then the next wave will be, you know, UNC. And Virginia is highly coveted, we think, by the Big Ten. And then NC State and Miami are kind of hanging in there. NC State tied into Miami. Could be the Big 12. For NC State. We'll see what happens there. The Duke part of that is because they're not a state school like North Carolina State and UNC, like Wake Forest and Duke and these other schools, you know, that could be the group that gets left behind. And there's a great unknown for Duke. And so football's the driving force behind all of this. We know the Notre Dame basketball brand on its own could really go be like Notre Dame football is and go play and do whatever it wants to do, but football's the revenue driver. So I think with the Dukes of the world and Wake Forest and those schools, a lot of unknown of what's going to happen on the football side. I think Carolina fans are just trying to wait and see, hey, once that door gets kicked open, is it going to be the Big Ten, the SEC? Because just a matter of time before absolute chaos. We saw it hit all the other conferences. It feels like the ACC is going to get rated next in just a matter of time.
And lastly, where do we stand right now in the idea of Charlotte landing an MLB expansion team?
Yeah, you know, obviously that comes up a lot. The minor league baseball park here gets voted to, or has a lot, the best minor league ballpark in every way possible. And that's how nice the ballpark is. But the problem with that is it's not major league ready. It's not a stadium that can just take a major league team without some major stuff going on. So it has to be new land, a whole new area. You know, there's the talk of getting a relocation of a team here. The Rays was that team for a while, which, you know, as an established franchise, we thought, oh, you know, that's a pretty good team to have here, but they're going to be staying in Florida. And then the other problem is, you know, the last couple of years, Nashville has gotten red hot for sports properties. So now they're angling for a team, and are they going to get one? And then Raleigh, 2 hours from Charlotte, you know, they only have the Hurricanes, but the way they support that team, they feel that they should have a team. So a lot of competition. They have to figure out the space. Then there's the fandom issue here because it's a very eclectic mix of fans here. We got a ton of Braves fans, obviously, in the South, but we've got a lot of Yankees, Mets, Cubs, as everywhere does, those national brands. And our question is always, you know, we get a team here. Some people are like, I'm all in. I'm rooting for that team. And then you have these lifelong fans of, like, the Cubs and the Dodgers, and they're like, yeah, I'll go support when my team is here. So it's a little complex on the fan side of how they would react to having a Charlotte Pro Baseball team.
Travis, appreciate you hopping on, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, thank you, guys. Have a good weekend.
It's raining in Baltimore.
We now got Glenn Clark of Glenn Clark Radio. Glenn, thanks for hopping on the show this afternoon.
Absolutely. Appropriately, it is raining in Baltimore. Not sure if we're going to be playing baseball tonight against the Diamondbacks.
Well, that's unfortunate because the first question I had involved baseball because the Orioles, as we know, are one of the best teams in Major League Baseball. Now, after last season's divisional series sweep by the Rangers, will this team make a deeper run in October than last season, or could you see a similar outcome?
I think right now it's going to be dependent on whether or not they can get the back end of the bullpen straightened out. Mm-hmm. So from a talent perspective, particularly the starting pitching, it's insane. One of the bigger issues facing the Orioles right now is they have too much starting pitching, which is just, for fans, a very pleasant sentence to say. Grayson Rodriguez was put on the injured list. He's going to be back, and there's no one to kick out of the rotation at the moment. They're probably going to end up going with a six-man rotation in June when they only have one day off, simply because there's no one to remove from the rotation at this point. But the back end of the bullpen is a mess right now. Craig Kimbrell, four of his last five outings, he's either blown a save or been pulled before he could blow the save. It's not been good. And the bullpen on the whole is pretty good, but the back end has got to be sorted out. They've got to either address that internally. Craig Kimbrell has to completely turn things around. At the moment, they're saying they're going to stick with them, but they can have a short leash for that, or they're going to have to address it at the trade deadline. At the moment, it looks like that's going to be the big story. They also need to do a little bit better job getting on base. They hit a ton of home runs. They've been leading the league in home runs hit, but they've been below the middle of the pack in on-base percentage. That's got to pick up a little bit, but they score enough runs that it's not a terrible concern at the moment.
Now, everybody in baseball is so aware of the farm system that Baltimore has put together, and the headliner, of course, being Matt Holliday's son, Jackson Holliday, who had his chance at the big league level earlier this season but mightily struggled, was sent back down to AAA. It doesn't really feel like there's any concern there, but has that, you know, maybe expectation dropped a little bit just since we've seen a taste of Jackson Holliday at the big league level so far?
Yeah, I don't know if the overall expectation has dropped. I think that maybe the time frame has dropped. I think there was a legitimate thought that Jackson Holliday could get here early in the season and be Rookie of the Year, make it back-to-back Rookies of the Year, and that seems a little bit less likely at the moment. But overall, they're very high on Jackson Holliday. You know, he's 20 years old. But there's time here. There's plenty of time with Jackson Holliday. And, you know, it took him a couple games to bounce back. I think he was still dealing with some of the disappointment. But he's gotten it going again at AAA and is right back to hitting 300 since he's been down there. I think it does speak to the expectations of this franchise and the amount of talent that they had, that they had such a shorter leash for Jackson Holliday. Truth be told, Gunnar Henderson, the first 2 months of the season a year ago, was about a 200 hitter. But the Orioles then were not looking at that as, we think we're going to win the World Series right now. So they were able to ride it out with Gunnar Henderson and let him keep going out there every day and work through it. And if this wasn't a team with World Series expectations, I think they probably would have ended up being willing to do the same thing with Jackson Holliday. But given the importance of the games, given the importance of the at-bats, they're just at a place they say, we've got enough major league players that you're going to have to go down there and figure it out at the minor league level. But I think he'll be back before too long. You know, I think Memorial Day, you start thinking about whether that might be the time frame that they're willing to give him another look. And who knows, maybe he could still work his way back into rookie of the year conversation.
Want to quickly jump over to the NFL side of things. And there had been some talk about Lamar Jackson's weight loss. Will that give him even more speed on the field, are you telling us?
I mean, yeah, it's a weird thing. There's a lot of obsession over it. I think there might have been times a year ago. So a year ago, Lamar Jackson decided to put on about 15 pounds. And a lot of the talk was, well, hey, this is how he helps withstand. If he's out running, he gets hit. It helps him withstand. The truth is, Lamar Jackson rarely gets hit downfield. This is one of the things that's made him different than other running quarterbacks that have been susceptible to injuries. Lamar Jackson's injuries have come when he's been in the pocket, not when he's been downfield, because when he's been downfield, he's been so elusive that he just doesn't take big hits. He gets out of bounds, or he gets down, or he scores touchdowns. Like, he just doesn't take those types of hits in the middle of the field. So I always thought it was a bit odd, the choice to put on the weight a season ago. There were times where it felt like he wasn't getting into that next gear as a runner. He was still incredibly dynamic. He was still very much a threat. But if he felt like it was hurting him getting into that next gear, then I think it makes sense. I just also never thought it was necessary, because he just doesn't, like, when he takes hits, it's in the pocket the way that other quarterbacks are taking hits. This notion that Lamar Jackson is more susceptible to injury because of his running has simply not been factual. He has not taken those types of hits in the NFL, so it does make more sense to me that he would go back to playing at the original weight that he was playing at when he was so absurdly dynamic.
Now, on the defensive side of things, the Ravens went to boost their secondary in the draft, going after Nate Wiggins, the cornerback out of Clemson. What was the overall reaction of that on draft night?
I think there was an initial, the bigger need was offensive line, but the way that the draft played out, and particularly Tyler Guyton going right before that, there wasn't really an offensive lineman on the board. So getting, you know, someone who was considered to be one of the best cornerbacks in the draft, I think the reaction was, this makes sense. It's a position where they needed some depth. They like using Marlon Humphrey inside, so being able to line Nate Wiggins up outside on day one makes a lot of sense, and that frees them up a little bit to allow Kyle Hamilton to be more of the kind of weapon X that we saw him as a year ago when he developed into one of the bigger stars defensively in the league. So I think it's very logical. I think the question becomes, they use their second round pick on a tackle, Roger Rosengarten from Washington, and they believe that he can be their starting right tackle on day one. And if that's the case, if he slides in and is that guy, then I think it ends up making this draft look really good for the Baltimore Ravens, because that was the biggest thing they faced, is they're overturning three-fifths of their starting offensive line from a year ago.
Glenn, thanks so much for your time, man. We'll see you next time.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend.
We're now going to hear from Jimmy Cook of 107.5 The Fan. Jimmy, how are we doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. I hope I am your only guest tonight that is live on site for a playoff game at Gambridge Fieldhouse. If that's not the case, then I'll still be okay throughout the night. Thank you for having me.
Oh, anytime, man. Perfect that we're going to talk some Pacers to kick off this segment. They're down 2-0 to the Knicks as the series heads back to Indiana. What's this feel right now? Is it panic time down 2-0, or is it throwing the towel time? Where are you at? Where's the fan base at with trailing the Knicks in this series?
Well, the conversation that we've had all week is a philosophical one. If your look on this series is glass half empty, you've blown 12-point and 9-point leads respectively in games 1 and 2, and now you're an 0-2 hole. If you're glass half full, you were in games on the road at Madison Square Garden. Yes, you're down 0-2, but you're back home in the friendly confines of Gambridge Fieldhouse with a depleted Knicks team without OG Anunoby tonight, and you haven't played all that bad. The areas that you're struggling, offensive rebounding, late in games especially, Pascal Siakam and Tyrese Halliburton disappearing at times, those areas are all correctable, all fixable. So I wouldn't say it is anything more than cautious optimism tonight, but if they drop tonight at Gambridge and fall 0-3, then you might as well bring the broom to Gambridge on Sunday.
Now, the Pacers are 7-point favorites tonight at home. Is that because of New York's injuries, or is there something you can tell us that we may not know about?
It has to be the injuries. I've been following that line relatively closely since things went final on Wednesday night. It opened as the Pacers as about 5-point favorites. That's not totally egregious when you factor in there usually about 2.5 or 3 points to what you're going to get as a home team in a fairly even matchup. But then as the news started to trickle out that, again, as we mentioned, OG Anunoby is going to be out tonight with a hamstring injury, and Jalen Brunson coming off his foot injury, even though I expect him to play tonight, the way that line is moved, I think, is more action that is winning on the Pacers with the thought that there's no possible way, and maybe they will, maybe there is a possible way, but there's no possible way the Knicks, with basically a six-man rotation, are going to be able to survive another night of Josh Hart, of Dante DiVincenzo, and of Jalen Brunson playing 40-plus minutes. If they do that, it's one of the greatest trio runs probably the last 4 or 5 years, non-Warriors division playoff history. And if they do that, the Pacers, again, are going to be going home.
Now, there's been some officiating controversy, of course, in Game 1 and Game 2 that happened at the Garden. And Carlisle was fined $35,000 for criticizing those said officials. Was it worth it to get that type of fine because of how this officiating has gone through the first two games of the series?
Rick Carlisle is experienced of a head coach, as you're going to find in the NBA. He has 40-plus years of experience in different roles within this league. He knows when you cross that line of criticizing officials that you're going to get your wallet hit. So you don't do that unless you're trying to really send a message to the league and to let them know, hey, we feel like that we're not getting a fair shake on things. My only issue with what he said, and I don't blame him because he was heated, he was frustrated, he was ticked off. I get it, but the step he probably took too far was suggesting that there's a bias from the league offices between small market and big market teams. The idea is ludicrous. Just look at the West right now. It's Oklahoma City and Minnesota in command of their series. Those are not franchises that a conspiracy league would want to have deep into the playoffs. So that was my only issue. But in terms of the angle, I totally get it. You got to go to bat for your guys. If not now, when? Because like I've said a couple times during our conversation today, if you lose tonight, you're done. Mm-hmm. No team has ever come back from 3-0 in NBA history. He saw a line in the sand that needed to be drawn, and he was willing to give up a little bit of pocket change for him to do it.
You talk about sending a message. The Pacers claim there were 78 missed calls between Game 1 and Game 2. Does that feel a little bit high, too low? Where do you stand on that?
Look, a couple of my brothers are attorneys. The way I see it, your goal is to overflow the opposition with just stacks and boxes of information, or in this case, clips. So do I think that's pretty hilarious that they found 78 instances? I don't know. Do I think it's about right? Probably. I don't know that I counted that many at home. But my bigger question was, who did the league pawn that job off onto? Because I don't know about you, but I'm not wanting to go sit through 78 additional clips after I probably already watched both those games to try to figure out if Rick Carlisle has a case or not.
Jimmy, I know the focus has been on the Pacers, but lastly, I got to know how excited the city is for Caitlin Clark to begin her WNBA career.
It's thrilling, man. 13,000 for a preseason game yesterday? Like, it's insane. I can't even quantify what this means, not just for women's sports, but for this proud franchise in the Indiana Fever. I mean, she's captivated not just girls and women, but basketball fans for 2 years. And for the Fever and Indiana, where we hold basketball especially true. You know, we view it as the birthplace of basketball here. To be able to have potentially the next great transcending star of the sport here is awesome. I'll have a better answer for you midsummer with how the city is adapted, but if it's anything like they already have, it's going to be bonkers. Just look at road arenas. Mm-hmm. WNBA teams are moving their games to accommodate for the type of turnout they expect for the Caitlin Clark experience. It's not just Clark, though. Aaliyah Boston and company, Aaliyah Boston, their first-round pick last year, they have a really good team. There's going to be struggles and growing pains, but the atmosphere, the excitement, the electricity of it all, it's already started. It started a preseason game last night.
Jimmy, appreciate your time, man, and have fun covering the game tonight.
Thanks. Also, big Chiefs fan, so go Chiefs. Looking forward to a three-peat run back next year. Let's go. See you guys.
We are back here on the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. I am your host, Jack Johnson, filling in for Seren Petro, alongside Curtis Ebel and Adam Dravetta, and joined in studio by our next guest. We had Danny from 3 to 4. Now we got Joel Penfield, the KC Sports Network and co-host of One Royal Way. Find their podcast on wherever you download your podcast. That can be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, I'm assuming.
I think Odyssey. So, and then YouTube as well. We're trying to get those subscribers up too.
YouTube as well, so be sure to subscribe if you like the visual of podcasting. I know I do. They do fantastic work over there. But Joel, I remember when we first started doing segments during the nighttime hours on 810, we had a baseball team that was hard to really get excited about. I mean, let's all be honest. You can get excited about individuals. You can be excited about players. But overall, you couldn't really spin it to the listener that, hey, things are happening here and things are happening for a reason in a positive way. Now, it's May 10th. This team is 7 games over .500. Don't know if people knew this, but if they win tonight in Anaheim, it'll be the first time they're 8 games over .500 since 2016. Is this a believable start? I remember Dayton Moore always brought up 40-game sample size. Is this a believable start, or are we all going to witness an epic collapse in the summer where this start's really not going to mean much when it's all said and done?
I think it's a fairly believable start. There are reasons to be optimistic about this team. The superstars are playing like those. Some of the role players are kind of growing into that. The starting pitching has been better than we could have ever anticipated. The bullpen has been spotty, but there are flashes of what it can be. I think they've done a really solid job of just weathering the storm. The schedule was not easy to begin the year. Mm-hmm. And I know that some teams that we thought were going to be pretty good were not as much, but you only play the teams that are on your schedule, and the Royals had beaten those teams, especially in Toronto and Houston. And if you had told me even, you know, before the year, the Royals would be 7 games under at this point, I'd be like, okay, maybe it's not great, but it's probably better than I thought it would be, or it's about what I thought it would be. They're 7 games over now, and in a wide-open AL Central, anything can happen. A lot of these teams at the 40-game mark are right around where the Royals are at. So we're going to get competitive baseball into June and July, which I think is all we can ask for right now, given where the Royals are at as they continue to try and build this thing.
I think what's funny, considering how the AL Central looked last year, is that, you know, you brought up with that tough schedule. If they were 7 games under .500, they'd be buried right now in that
division. I know, yeah.
And they find themselves a game and a half back of Cleveland, who's been one of the better teams in all of baseball. Minnesota's won 15 of 17, and the Royals are still neck and neck with them. Detroit blinked, and they're 5 games back now. They just had a bad series against the Yankees, and then they had a bad series against Cleveland. They should have probably taken 2, but they got walked off in Game 3, the finale of that series. Of the American League Central teams, of course, we're ruling out Chicago here. Who is the one that alarms you the most? And I know it's between Cleveland and Minnesota. Detroit, I feel like, is not just going to be that team at the end that's the top dog, the alpha. But between Minnesota, between Cleveland, who do you think is the team the Royals should be fearing right now to get that crown of the Central?
It's Minnesota. What Cleveland has done this so far this year has been exceptional. I thought the Shane Bieber injury was going to bury them. Like, that's your ace going down. He's going to be out for a year. I did. And they have some solid young pitchers, but they've taken so much attrition in the starting rotation that I don't think they have enough to sustain over the course of the season. Minnesota, Joe Ryan, Pablo Lopez, Chris Paddock is a great 1-2-3. Bailey Ober's solid as well. They're starting to hit a lot more than they were earlier in the year, which was a lot of the reasons why they struggled. The offense was just bad, and now Correa is starting to get going. Eduardo Julian is a great underrated hitter. Ryan Jeffers is hitting. All of those guys are, and if they get Buxton back, who knows? So I would say they're probably the team to beat in the division. They're the team I picked before the year to win the division. So that would be probably where it's going to end up.
We're talking with Joel Penfield of KC Sports Network and co-host of One Royal Way in studio right here on the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Want to get into this lineup a little bit because you've got, of course, the elite hitters in your lineup, Bobby Witt Jr. being one, Salvador Perez being another. Now, after he's seemingly snapped out of a slump for the second time this year, Vinny Pasquantino, and Michael Garcia has been very good over the last 3 to 4 weeks or so. So there's four hitters in your lineup, and shockingly, they're the first four hitters that actually go through in the lineup. And then you've got five guys that are all kind of interchangeable when you think about it. There are five different guys, it feels like. Massey will play one day, then it'll be Frazier. Hampson sometimes plays, and then it's Melendez, and then it's Blanco. It can be interchangeable at the bottom of the order. How long can the Royals go with structure like that, where the first four you feel good about? Maybe right now five, because Michael Massey's been pretty hot of late. But really, four consistent guys, and then five you just really don't know, and the majority of those five have been performing well under expectation.
Yeah, I don't know how much longer it can sustain. You can only expect so much from those guys, and obviously when you have top-level guys like Salvador Perez, Bobby Witt Jr., they can help carry a lineup. Vinny Pasquantino, when he's right, he can help carry a lineup. But you can't expect over 162 games for just to get production from those four. It has to come from other guys. Michael Massey's been really good as of late. Took him a couple of games to get his timing back, but it seems like the power's come back for him, which is a big deal. Dyron Blanco has actually been kind of sneaky good. I don't think he's an everyday player, but there's at least some value there. But Garrett Hampson's been mostly a disaster. Hunter Renfroe has been mostly a disaster. Adam Frazier, I don't really know. It's about what I thought Adam Frazier was going to be, which isn't great. So I just don't know how much longer you can run those guys out every single day. The problem is the Royals gave a lot of those guys free agent contracts, so they have to be willing to own up to the mistake and just go, you know what, this isn't working. We got to move on. I don't know if they're going to do that until probably June. We're going to probably have to go a couple more weeks so they get a larger sample than just 100 plate appearances or so. Yeah. If it gets about that 150 to 200 mark with most of those guys, you'll see some roster moves made.
I know for some Royals fans out there that want to see change, want to look to the minor league level and go, hey, why not this guy? The common name that comes up is Drew Waters because of the way that he's hit down with the Storm Chasers this year. But where do you stand on it? Do you view Drew Waters as a future fix to this lineup where once you call him up and he's the everyday right fielder, because I doubt they move Isbell off of center
field. They're not going to.
Yeah, I think that they love his defense too much out there. Is Drew Waters the fix to the offensive struggles at the bottom of the order? Or is he somebody maybe right now the Royals view as more of a trade piece than an actual part to this lineup?
I haven't considered the trade aspect. That's pretty interesting. Maybe just try and stash him in AAA and make it look like the changes are legit. I am not a huge Drew Waters fan because I think, and I've said this on the podcast quite a bit, that I think the idea of Drew Waters is much better than Drew Waters in practice. Like, what he actually is, I'm just not sure. The talent, he oozes it. I mean, the speed, there's some legitimate power there. He's a solid defender. Like, you think he has the makings of a solid everyday big leaguer, and he just has never really put it together. And he's still striking out a fair amount in AAA. He's got a career strikeout rate around 33% in the big leagues. That's just not going to cut it. And he doesn't have enough contact skills to make up for it. So it's not like he's putting the ball in play a ton either. And he's not the defender that Kyle Isbell is. So it's not like there's a one-to-one there. If you stick him at a corner, it's probably fine. But he really has to hit. And I don't think he's going to hit enough for it to be the true fix. Is he probably better than some of the options that the Royals are putting out there in the corner outfield spots right now? Yes. But I'm not going to act like he's a savior. And I think people are looking at him that he can be that. He's not. Can he maybe fix in the short term? Sure. Over a larger sample, I don't think so.
Now, one thing that makes me believe the Royals are looking for a fix is that I think it was earlier this week it was reported that the Royals at least made a call about Luis Arraez until I think J.J. Bacolowicz had said that they were just much further, the Padres were much further along in that process than the Royals ever were. Ken Rosenthal reported it didn't really make it past the preliminary talks. But is something like that worth noting, that this early into the season, the Royals weren't just going after somebody who was DFA'd, oh, let's just swap, you know, a minor leaguer for a guy we don't want to go through waivers because we fear somebody else can take him? Or is this a scenario where already J.J. Bacol and that front office are going, we need an extra boost, we need some more firepower if we really think we can sustain this long enough to be in a divisional hunt when it's all said and done?
I think it's fair to consider and be noteworthy. I don't think it means the Royals are going to make a move now or even maybe into June. If they're still in it mid-July, sure, I think they might. I might see them making a move, but I'm not going to bank on it. They're trying to build something sustainable over the long term. And sure, you can always improve your club, but you don't want to mortgage everything that they're doing right for the right now when they're trying. They've talked about trying to build something now. It's not like if Bobby Witt Jr., if they hadn't signed the extension and they really wanted to try and win in year three with him, then sure. But he's locked up for so long now, I don't think they need to mortgage all of that to try and make a run at the division now. If it happens, awesome, and I think they'll make some moves if they're still in it into mid-July, but I'm not gonna say they're gonna go and make something splashy like San Diego did trying to get a rise. But it is noteworthy that they at least made the call, at least had the conversation.
We're here with Joel Penfield of KC Sports Network and co-host of One Royal Way. I have a fun question for you here, although it comes from a negative moment. James MacArthur on Tuesday night, blowing the save. We'd all kind of leaned into White Horse, and he's got the closer entrance. Although, what I didn't realize is that Chris Stratton also got the lights to flicker for him when he came in. So it was more so of the Royals just giving the ninth inning guy something to work with going into the game. But after that loss, people were angry. They were frustrated. Don't give this guy a closer's entrance if he's going to do that, which was, of course, the utter collapse against the Brewers in which Willy Adames had the go-ahead three-run home run. With James MacArthur, for those people out there angry about entrances, does it really matter? Should you have to get more of a status before you can have an elite closer's entrance like a Johan Duran, like an Edwin Diaz? Or is this just, we're worrying about something that doesn't matter at all?
Worrying about something that doesn't matter, guys. The overreaction was so laughable and embarrassing. It really was. James MacArthur, the home run that he gave up to Jonah Heim on Sunday, that was the first time he had given up a run in the ninth inning, and people wanted him to be out of the closer's role after that game. Obviously, it goes poorly on Monday or Tuesday, which it happens. Like no. This is not it is naive to believe that when your closer comes out that they are 100% of the time going to close out the game. It happens. It's done. He gets out there the next day. When they really needed it, things got a little hairy in the ninth inning because Tyler Duffy couldn't get those last three outs. They were trying to save MacArthur, and instead he goes out, three pitches, gets it done, gets some confidence back. The locker room and the clubhouse had his back even before the game. Vinny Pasquantino had a great quote, as a vote of confidence for James MacArthur. He's going to be your closer. He's going to be the guy. And I ask those that don't want him to be a closer, who do you give the ninth inning to?
I was going to say, I don't think there is a ninth inning guy, and that was something I believe, Curtis, you said as well when looking at another option of people in the moment of anger of blowing that game on Tuesday night. It was somebody else has to go out there. Who?
Yeah, who's the only other guy? The only person I would have thought maybe had the ability would be Schreiber, and I don't think
somebody's got to bridge the gap.
In 120 more professional major league games, he had exactly, at that time, had exactly two more saves in his career than did MacArthur. The other hot name that night, in my mentions, was Angel Serpa, who has pitched in the ninth inning twice in his 76 innings, and both were at the end of relief stints. So, I think people think that every reliever is 2015 Wade Davis, and the minute they give up a run, it's like you're playing Strato cards. Oh, pull him, put the other card in. You know, you don't know that's if that's your guy, that's your guy. And relievers, closers give up runs fairly frequently.
Yeah,
you don't see guys out there who were 40 of 42. So
And there's only a handful of guys in MLB history with that type of thing. Like, it was like Eric Gagne, Jose Valverde had 1 year, but like reliever volatility is just the nature of the beast. And he's on a great run. He had two bad outings, and he turned right around and got the save the next day. He didn't let it affect him, and I think that shows that he has a mentality to close out games. It could have continued to snowball on him, and he could have completely unraveled the Royals, lose that series to the Brewers. Instead, ground ball, get out of there, and get out of there with a win.
Well, we were just talking to Glenn Clark during the two-minute drill about Craig Kimbrel and, you know, the struggles that he's had of late. And Craig Kimbrel's arguably top three closer of the 2010s. I mean, everybody's going to remember the illustrious career when it's all said and done. But Baltimore put a lot of faith into him in a year that they believe they can win the World Series. And here he is in four of his last five outings giving up runs, right? It's just we magnify it when a closer gives up a run, even if it's 5-2 and he gives up two runs and gets a save. It's, oh, he's not very good. But if that happens in the sixth inning, it's just not a great outing. But closers have so much pressure. And to me, at the end of the day, it's about putting the guy with the best pure stuff who can, you know, get the final three outs of a game. Do I think John Schreiber has the best stuff in the bullpen? No, which is why I wouldn't put him there in the ninth. Is Chris Stratton? No, I wouldn't say so. Even Serpa, we fell in love with what Serpa did, right? He can go two innings, right? But he's not a closer, right? Not everybody that has a good outing or two is a closer.
He's been great in the fifth and sixth and seventh.
And it's different than the ninth.
Teams don't empty the bench in the sixth inning. Yeah. Empty the bench in the ninth.
Yeah, and I also thought what was funny about that MacArthur outing on Tuesday night, right, the debate of nibbling to Gary Sanchez, right? Why didn't he give Gary Sanchez a competitive pitch? Did we forget that the night before he took 96 down and in from Cole Reagans into the fountains, and that Wednesday game Nick Anderson put 96 on the bottom corner right on the black, and he hit it over the wall in right center field? You can't just give Gary Sanchez a fastball. He's a very strong man. He could have tied that game, and the hindsight's always 20/20, right? Why'd you walk that guy and give up the home run then? I'd rather have just had the game be tied. Well, that's just a terrible closer's mentality. I'm just going to give him a pitch to hit because I don't want to nibble here. He was clearly trying to get the swing and miss there on Gary Sanchez. He laid off, but fortunately on Wednesday, he gets another opportunity. He faces Contreras and Christian Yelich, them representing the tying run in the plate, kind of similar to what he saw on Tuesday night, and got it done, what, two or three pitches?
Three pitches, yeah.
Three pitches, and he was out of it, and now we all feel much better about James MacArthur. We'll take our second break here of the third hour on the program. When we come back, we will roll on with Joel Penfield of KC Sports Network on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the Joe's Kansas City Barbecue burnt end of the hour answer. How many teams have won by 24 and lost by 24 in consecutive home playoff games? One, the Boston Celtics this week. No team had ever pulled that off. Win by 24 at home, lose by 24 at home in back-to-back games.
I think we're going to see more of that, though. Serena talks a lot about with the integration, I mean, not the integration, the three-point has been here a long time, but with the emphasis on three-point shooting, you're going to have games where one team is incredibly hot and the other team's average, or one team's average, the other team's way cold, things like that sort of. It's more predisposed to blowouts.
Wasn't it, I think it was last year, Boston and Miami, that game at the Garden, and Boston came out red hot, and that game ended up being a blowout. Like, it can be that quickly, where you hit five of your first six.
Mm-hmm.
The game's not going to even out at some point. It doesn't need to even out, really.
Yeah.
If you're not hot from deep, you're probably not going to win that game.
And if one team starts out incredibly hot, and all of a sudden it's you know, 25-10, and then the team that's down 15 just plays their average game from the rest of then on. They're not going to be able to close that.
It happened to Oklahoma City last night against Dallas. Dallas was 12-24 from three in the first half, after going 12-38 in game one and after the whole game. So, yeah, it can happen that fast.
By the way, Joe's Kansas City Barbecue.
Oh,
go get
goodness.
That this weekend.
Oh. I'm going to get that in a little over an hour.
The Rocket Pig, what's your go-to?
I usually get the Rocket Pig in a ring, but I'm going to get the Dirty Rice.
Dirty Rice.
I haven't had the Dirty Rice.
The Dirty Rice is just the perfect spicy. Everyone talks about, like, everyone just says perfect. This, and I think there's a lot of truth to it. The best spicy is when it's spicy enough to accent the flavor, not just so spicy it makes your mouth go numb. Joe's nails that.
Take about three bites, and you're like, hey, there's a little kick there. That's pretty good.
But it doesn't, you know, it's good. It's not just like you're eating a contest of just the spiciest food in the world. It's really good.
The chip contest.
It's Salvador Perez's.
Really good.
It's Salvador Perez's birthday. Do you think if he was here, he would be celebrating it at Joe's?
If he was with Chris Jones, he would.
I was going to say, Chris Jones every Monday is cheat meal.
And Sal would say, thank you, my friend.
How much food do you think could be consumed between those two? At Joe's.
Quite a bit.
Just give them a table. I don't think there's enough burn ends in that place to feed those two guys.
You just raise your hand. It's like one of those, like that's when I was in Surprise with Serena. It was one of those Brazilian steakhouses with the green sign, red sign. Just do that at Joe's.
I would do that.
I'd do that too.
Something hauling me out by my feet later.
Something Joe's needs to consider, it's been months now, the night of the NBA All-Star weekend, the skills contest, the Saturday night, we got, my buddy, we got just some baked mac and cheese, and then we went to Joe's and got burn-ins, and put the burn-ins in the mac and cheese, so a little side suggestion for... Not even side, that's a full-on meal. Suggestion for Joe's if you want to. Because anything Joe's decides to do, like the Rocket Pig sandwich, anything they add to the menu, you know is going to be incredible because they work at it. They make sure, and they spend so much time getting it right before they put that on their menu. So anything new on their menu, you know is going to be on point.
Yep.
I am usually somebody that I don't like to be a messy eater, but that's one place that I don't think anybody cares.
No.
That's just barbecue places in general.
Yeah,
you can be messy.
It's in part of the intended purpose.
You can look pretty sloppy at a table and not really have a care in the world about it. Every other place, no, you got to clean yourself up a little bit. But for barbecue, doesn't really matter to me. Tonight, the Royals will have Game 2 against the Angels in Anaheim. Alec Marsh getting activated off the injured list after getting hit by a comebacker on the forearm. I think they called it an elbow contusion when it was all said and done. But he's now back in the rotation. I want to quickly highlight this group. This starting five, if you will. How long can they keep up a stretch like this? Last night was quality start number 19 for this squad on May 9th. They had 32 last year as a team. They are going to unbelievably shatter that total, assuming all things go well. They are going to shatter that total probably before the end of June, I would say. Just considering who they're going to be facing and who they're going to be going up against. Is it sustainable? And if it's not, how much longer can they go?
It's sustainable to a degree. Like they are going to come back to earth a little bit, but a lot of the expected numbers and the ERA FIP discrepancies are not so drastic that they're going to fall off the face of the earth. Like they're going to go from probably somewhere in the 8 to 10 range among starting pitching to 12 to 14, which is perfectly fine for where the Royals are at. Like Cole Reagan's the FIP is actually a full run lower than his ERA because he's not giving up a lot of home runs. Seth Lugo is the ERA is 1.92. He's not going to do that over a full season, but the FIP is 3.78, and I think the expected ERA is somewhere in the either high threes, low fours. And if that's what you get from Seth Lugo over a full season, probably in that 170 inning range, perfectly fine. That's requisite value for a $15 million pitcher. Alec Marsh has been fantastic for this team. He may come back a little bit. Brady Singer's been pitching to exactly what he was going to be. I'm really excited for what they're going to do. I thought Michael Wacha looked pretty good until that seventh inning. At least good to see him bounce back.
Yeah, it unraveled a little bit for him in the seventh inning. But Daniel Lynch and his, I guess, PFPs in the offseason really paid off because that was one hell of a double play.
Pitchers are athletes.
They are. Certainly Daniel Lynch is one. Joel, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for coming in studio, by the way.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
That is Joel Penfield of KC Sports Network, co-host of One Royal Way. Find their podcast on wherever you listen to podcasts, and also give them a subscriber on YouTube. They do fantastic work over there. Joel, Jordan Foot, Josh Kaiser, just excellent work. Go give them a follow on all those platforms, but more specifically on YouTube. We will begin hour number four of the program coming up next on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
As you may have heard, Salvador Perez, 34 today, off what pitcher?
Happy birthday!
Did he hit his first big league home run? Brought to you by Good Sense.